blue and shiny as a puddle. After lunch, I take Mabel up to the hill. Fractious gusts of wind rattle the hedgerows, blowing voluminous shoals of leaves over us as we walk up the track. There's sticky mud and pheasant prints in it. Flocks of field fares chack-chack and dodge in the hawthorns by the cow field, breaking low when we get too near, bouncing over the hedge and away in thrushy strobes of black and white. It's nice to see them. Proper winter is here. And Mabel is fizzing with happiness, wagging her tail in barely suppressed excitement, tummy feathers fluffed over her grippy toes, eyes gleaming silver in the sun. If this hawk could speak, she'd be singing under her breath. Something has changed inside me. Today it's hard to slip into the exquisite, wordless sharpness of being a hawk. Or rather, the hawk seems more human today. A rabbit lopes across the path 20 yards away and she chases it, swings up into a poplar, clutching onto a thin, near-vertical branch and leaning into the wind, narrow as a stoat. She looks about, sees something, goes to the next tree, looks down, then flies back to the first one. I proffer my fist. She comes down immediately, and off we go again. "Rah," she says, "more." By the hay rolls, we sneak through the side of the wood and then make our way to the corner of the top field. I'm a little blurry. I've combated the drug-induced tiredness with 2 double espressos at breakfast and a caffeinated soda after lunch. I'm hoping that the drugs will prevent the rampant paranoia that this excess of caffeine will inevitably provoke. Mabel clocks a pile of wood pigeons on plough 1/4 mile away and makes as if to bait at them. "Don't be daft, Mabes," I say, but she baits anyway. "Pah," she looks me directly in the face. "Give me something to chase." I do. We walk through chest-high thistles at the corner of the next field, hawk held high as I negotiate the thorns. She's gripping hard with all 8 talons, bracing herself against the oncoming gusts of wind. And then, out of nowhere, coming out of the ground, right from where the tip of my shadow ends, a cock pheasant in bronze and bottle green, all rackety tail and sharp primaries, clatters up from the dry grass, Goss already close behind. He turns downwind. She's gaining on him, no more than 6 inches behind the tip of his tail. But she hasn't flown much in winds like this, and mistimes her attack, is pushed by the wind a little askew, and the pheasant pulls away, climbs up over the wood. She follows, and both are lost to view. I'm just about to start running, but she's already on her way back to me, coming in at treetop height over the wood like a Mustang in a war movie. One vast, stylish arc carving right through the barricade of oncoming air, like, "Here I come!" And she's back on the fist, grinning like an idiot, and her whole attitude is like, "Well, what did you think of that?" As the days drive deeper into winter, a small and fugitive gleam begins to touch the edges of things. It happens without much fuss. I catch myself watching the sky in the morning and liking simply how it looks. Gone is the Ostringer's calculating eye, concerned only with wind speed, bearing, likely precipitation. I call on old friends, make plans for the future. I look for a house to rent. My mother comes to visit. I go back to the doctor to discuss my progress. He tells me the deep, blurry tiredness is a side effect of the drugs, and that it will soon pass. The American writer and ecologist Aldo Leopold once wrote that falconry was a balancing act between wild and tame, not just in the hawk, but inside the heart and mind of the falconer. That is why he considered it the perfect hobby. I'm starting to see the balance is righting now, and the distance between Mabel and me increasing. I see, too, that her world and my world are not the same, and some part of me is amazed that I ever thought they were. Then I find myself doing something surprising. I raise Mabel's weight even more, and let her range more widely when she flies. This is terrible falconry. Never let a goshawk self-hunt, say the books. Such independence is the fastest way to lose your hawk. I know I shouldn't slip her unless there's quarry right there in front of her, but how can I resist this method of hawking? Today I walked up to the crest of a hill on a freezing, smoky afternoon. The whole Cambridgeshire countryside laid out in front in woods and fields and copses beneath us, all bosky and bright with golden sunshine. And I can see that what Mabel wants to do is launch a prospecting attack on the hedgerow over the rise. I let her go. Her tactical sense is magnificent. She drops from the fist and sets off, no higher than a hand's width above the ground, using every inch of the undulating relief as cover, gathering speed until the frosty stubble winks and flashes under her, and she curves over the top of the hill. Then she sets her wings and glides, using gravity and momentum to race downhill, flash up over the top of the hedge in a sudden flowering of cream and white, a good 100 yards away, and then continue down the hedge's far side, invisible to me. I'm running all this time, my feet caked with mud, feeling earthbound, but transported at the same time. I find her in the hedge bottom, holding on to a rabbit. Mabel, I say, you're behaving like a wild hawk. Shocking. This is nerve-wracking falconry, but a wonderful thing. I am testing the lines between us that the old falconers would have called love. They have not broken. They do not look likely to break. Maybe they will. I raise her weight even more, and slowly the world widens. But I'm pushing my luck, and I know it. She's not in condition, I tell myself, all the way there in the car. You'll lose her. It is 2 days later and I can hear the voice of reason telling me to go back home. I keep driving. Rain spots the windscreen and spines the near side windows. Will the rabbits be lying out in this weather? Maybe. I park on the muddy verge against the wet fence at the far side of the field. She's not in Yarrock, but she's looking about. Whatever, I think. I change her jesses and let her go. She chases a rabbit to its hole and swings up into an oak tree. I whistle. She doesn't seem to hear me. The rain starts falling in earnest. At this point, I realize something has changed about the space between the goshawk and me. Usually it's taut with attention. When she flies into a tree, all my attention is turned to the hawk, and the hawk turns all her attention to me. Not anymore. She ignores me. There is something religious about the activity of looking up at a hawk in a tall tree. Sir Thomas Shirley wrote in the 17th century that flying falcons turns one's eyes to the heavens, which is why falconry is a moral activity. This seems more akin to falling to my knees begging redemption from an indifferent deity. Mabel flies on, deeper into the trees. I follow her. She's still ignoring me. Look at me, hawk! I'm willing up at the treetops, and she doesn't. I find myself on someone's lawn. I've trailed dark footfalls across the blue grass. The hawk is 30 feet above me, and I'm shouting and whistling like a madwoman. Rain blows everywhere. I caper about. I chuck chick corpses high in the air. They fall with a thump to the grass, and she doesn't even turn her head to track their sad parabolae. I whistle some more, wave my arms. Mabel, I shout. Come on! A sash window grates. An upstairs window of the huge Georgian house I've been pretending isn't there. A maid leans out. Black dress, white pinafore, white hat. Nothing about this strikes me as strange. I have followed my hawk and walked backwards in time. It's 1923. Any minute now, Poirot will wander towards me across the lawn. Only later do I realize I had probably interrupted some erotic afternoon adventure. "Are you all right?" she calls. "I'm really sorry," I shout back. "I've lost my hawk." I point vaguely up at the tree. "I'm trying to get her back. I'm so sorry to trespass on your lawn. I'll be gone soon, just desperate to get her back." "Oh?" She thinks about it for a second, looks up at the tree. Then she looks down at me. "That's fine," she says. "I only wanted to see if you were all right." She slams the window. The window slams hard, and the hawk moves. She flies from tree to tree, taking me away from the lawn towards the edge of the wood. The trees here are taller. Now my hawk is the size of a thumbnail. Light shines dully from her spangled front. And out of nowhere, her half-sized copy, a miniature doppelganger, appears. The female sparrowhawk stoops at her, turns and stoops again. It's like Peter Pan being mobbed by his own shadow. My hawk flies to the next tree. By now I have no discernible thoughts. I know she won't come down. I must just follow her, stumbling through bushes in a quixotic delirium. "Snowberries," I think, as the white nubs brush against my hawking waistcoat. Didn't Victorian gamekeepers plant them as cover for pheasants? Oh no. As soon as the thought is made, I see her twist out of the treetop, swerve to avoid a branch, and then stoop at a 50-degree angle, wings almost entirely closed. It's exciting enough to make me hold my breath, but I haven't time. I'm already running. I duck under an electric fence, and my heart sinks. She's stooped into a city of pheasants. They are everywhere. We shouldn't be here. We shouldn't be here. I can hear her bell ringing. Where is she? Over the muddy ditch, and I'm in the wood. It is silent with leaves and fear. Then I hear pheasants running. I see one, two, three, crouching in mortal terror. And then a blue-rumped cock pheasant burning copper against the leaves kicked up behind him, running hell for leather along the ground 30 feet away. Mabel comes up behind him like a gust of wind carrying the angel of death. I can't stop this. Nothing can. She's moving faster than seems plausible, powering down on a glide slope that ends abruptly. She binds to the pheasant with both feet, just as he sticks his head into a pile of brushwood, and then all hell breaks loose. Leaves fly, feathers fly, pheasant wings batter, and I'm running. I'm nearly passing out with stress, crouching, dirty, covered in mud and sweat, pulsing with adrenaline. The goshawk is full of adrenaline too. She's killing the pheasant more, even though it's dead. Stamp, stamp, gripe, stamp, foot, clutch, stamp. Leaves continue to fly as she dances about on it. Her eyes burn with an unholy light. Her beak is open. She looks terrifying. Slowly, she calms down. I keep looking back behind me. No one is in sight. I feed her all the food in my waistcoat and give her the whole head and neck of the pheasant. I sneak the pheasant itself into the capacious back pocket of the waistcoat, breaking its long tail feathers in half so no telltale ends poke out of the zip, and guiltily heap leaves all over the scene of the crime. And then we sneak back to the car. I am undone. From the four corners of the field I'm crossing, from all sides, every single cock pheasant in the neighborhood begins to crow simultaneously. It's a terrible, echoing, barreling sound, like an echo effects pedal on long sustain, rolling backwards and forwards through the air. It swells into the most terrifying, sustained cacophony, more like an artillery bombardment than calling birds. It is a vast alarum of accusation. I am guilty. I've poached a pheasant from someone's shoot. "I didn't mean to," I almost say out loud. "It was an accident." I'm relieved when the calls die away, and then, as I round the corner to the car, the barrage starts again. Chastened and slightly unnerved, I drive away, the pheasants gone but conscience ringing in my ears. The landscape is changing before my eyes. What I see is not just winter moving onwards to spring. It is a land filling slowly with spots and lines of beauty. There's brittle sun out on the hill this lunchtime and a fresh westerly wind. Mabel's pupils shrink to opiated pinpricks as I unhood her, both of her eyes narrow with happiness. It is exceptionally clear. The red flag over the range cracks with the wind and the sound of distant rifles. The radio mast on the horizon looks like an ink drawing over a wash of shadows and lines and bolts of land rippling up to the chalk hills before me. We walk up the track. From the top, I can look down and see the whole of Cambridge. The light today is beguiling. The rooftops and spires seem within a hand's grasp, a chess-set town glittering among bare trees, as if I could pick up the brute tower of the university library and move it 6 places north, set it down somewhere else. From here, the city is mild and small, and looks all of a piece with the landscape around it. The beauty of a vantage like this is that it obscures the roads and walls with trees, makes Cambridge a miniature playset of forest-set blocks and spires. These days, when I go into town, I'm increasingly finding excuses to park my car in the multi-story car park, because from the open-air fourth floor, I can stare at these fields. They run like a backbone across the horizon, scratched with copse lines and damped with cloud shadow. A strange complication arises when I look at them, something of a doubling. Leaning out over the car park rail, I feel myself standing on the distant hill. There's a terrible strength to this intuition. It's almost as if my soul really is up there, several miles away, standing on thistly clay, watching my soulless self standing in the car park, with diesel and concrete in her nose and anti-skid asphalt under her feet. With the car park self thinking, if she looked very, very hard, perhaps through binoculars, she might see herself up there. I feel I might be up there because now the hill is home. I know it intimately. Every hedgerow, every track through dry grass where the hares cut across field boundaries, each discarded piece of rusted machinery, every earth and warren and tree. By the road, half an acre of fenced-off mud, scaled with tire tracks and water reflecting pieces of sky. Wagtails, pallets, tractors, a broken silo on its side like a fallen rocket stage. Here is the sheep field. There is the clover lay, now mown and turned to earth. Further up the track, are tracts of mugwort, dead now from frost, seeds clinging to stems and branches like a billion musty beads on ragged Christmas trees. Piles of bricks and rubble run along the left-hand side of the track, and the earth between them is soft and full of rabbits. Further up the hill, the hedges are higher, and by the time I get to the top, the track has narrowed into grass, cow parsley, knapweed, wild burdock, the argillaceous shimmer of tinder-fine clay, drifts of chalk beneath, yellowhammers chipping in the hedges, cumulus rubble, the maritime light of this island, set as it is under a sky mirrored and uplit by sea. I don't own this land. I've only got permission to fly here. But in walking it over and over again and paying it the greatest attention, I've made it mine. I know where its animals live and how they move about it. Know that the larks sleep on the top of the hill. But on sunny mornings they move to warm themselves on eastward slopes. That when the weather is wet but the rain has stopped, the rabbits in the warrens near the ditches move eastward onto the drier fields to graze. This sense of where the animals are is the coincidence of long experience with unconsciously noted clues. The incidence of sunlight on a stubble field and the pressure of wind on the same, the precise colour of the ground. I move towards the larks as if I could see them. But the biggest field, one planted with oilseed rape, is not like the others. It is a mystery. Walking it with Mabel is like playing natural historical battleships. Anything could be living in those thick-packed bluish leaves. Pheasants, partridges, hares, even a jack snipe whirring up with snappy wing beats from a muddy patch near the hedge. It seems ludicrous that anything could be invisible in a bare 2 inches of herbage, but everything is. There is a sense of creation about it. When the hare leapt up from our feet today, it was as if it had been made by the field ex nihilo. The hare had an ally, a strong northeasterly. Mabel tried twice to grab it, and both times it jinked across the wind and she missed. It is very strange watching a hawk chase a land animal in a high wind. The hare has purchase. Its claws and furry pads dig into leaves and mud, and it uses the ground to propel itself against. But the hawk moves in air alone. It is like watching one element against another, one world versus another, like a gannet diving into the sea for fish. I am glad she did not catch the hare. There is the tree Mabel dived from to cosh me on the head. There's the invisible line in the air along which, for the very first time, she followed a cock pheasant to cover. There's the hedge, where she clung, tail fanned wide, wings pressed against twigs, looking for a pigeon already gone. There is the bramble bush that tripped me and pitched me into a flooded ditch. The hawk and I have a shared history of these fields. There are ghosts here, but they are not long-dead falconers. They are ghosts of things that happened. It's a child's world, full of separate places. Give me a paper and pencil now and ask me to draw a map of the fields I roamed about when I was small, and I cannot do it. But change the question and ask me to list what was there, and I can fill pages. The wood ant's nest, the newt pond, the oak covered in marble galls, the birches by the motorway fence with fly agarics at their feet. These things were the waypoints of my world. And other places became magic through happenstance. When I found a huge red underwing moth behind the electricity junction box at the end of my road, that box became a magic place. I needed to check behind it every time I walked past, though nothing was ever there. I'd run to check the place where once I'd caught a grass snake, look up at the tree that, one afternoon, had held a roosting owl. These places had a magical importance, a pull on me that other places did not, however devoid of life they were in all the visits since. And now I'm giving Mabel her head and letting her fly where she wants, I've discovered something rather wonderful. She is building a landscape of magical places, too. She makes detours to check particular spots, in case the rabbit or the pheasant that was there last week might be there again. It is wild superstition. It is an instinctive heuristic of the hunting mind, and it works. She is learning a particular way of navigating the world, and her map is coincident with mine. Memory and love and magic. What happened over the years of my expeditions as a child was a slow transformation of my landscape over time into what naturalists call a local patch, glowing with memory and meaning. Mabel is doing the same. She is making the hill her own. Mine. Ours. Chapter 26. The Flight of Time. It's turned cold. Cold so that sources of ice lie in the mud, blank and crazed as antique porcelain. Cold so the hedges are alive with Baltic blackbirds, so cold that Each breath hangs like parceled sea fog in the air. The blue sky rings with it, and the bell on Mabel's tail is dimmed with condensation. Cold, cold, cold. My feet crack the ice in the mud as I trudge uphill. And because the squeaks and grinding harmonics of fracturing ice sound to Mabel like a wounded animal, every step I take is met with a convulsive clench of her toes. Where the world isn't white with frost, it's striped green and brown in strong sunlight. So the land is particolored and snapping backwards to dawn and forwards to dusk. The days now are a bare 6 hours long. It's my first day out with Mabel for a week. I've been interviewing students for my old college. For 4 days I've sat in front of frightened faces, asking them searching questions while trying to put them at ease. It was hard work. It felt like those first days with Mabel all over again. Now the interviews are over, and today I've been seduced by the weather. It is such a beautiful, fiery day, burning with ice and fine prospects, that I cannot imagine not being on the hill. I know my hawk is too high. I also know that after 4 days of enforced rest, she will be wanting to hunt very much indeed. What's more, I've run out of chicks. Mabel has been eating nothing but quail for a week, and it's made her a hot-tempered, choleric, Hotspur-on-Coke revenge tragedy protagonist goshawk. She's full of giddy, nowhere-to-go desire. She foots her perch. She gets cross. She jumps in the bath and out again, and then in again. She glares. Feed bloody food but 3 times a week, say the old books. Too much rich food, and this is what happens. Already I can see the mood she's in, and I suspect if I let her go here, she'll fly straight to the nearest tree and ignore me. So I take her to the top field. There are no trees up there. If she leaves the fist, there'll be no close perch to fly to. She'll swing about in midair and come back to me. And she does, for a while, but then she starts eyeing the far hedge. I can't see beyond it. Mabel knows there are pheasants in there, woodpigeons too, and rabbit holes along the ditch. She starts that curious auto-cue parallax bobbing of her head and makes as if to go. And I let her go. It is stupid of me, but I do. She flips her wings, glides away, and disappears behind the hedge. I am strangely calm. I don't even run. I amble in a leisurely manner towards it. Then realize, heart thumping, that I have no idea where she is. The hedge before me is an 8-foot wall of blackthorn needles. It's impassable. I run up and down looking for passage. There, a gap the size of a porthole between 2 sturdy branches. I squirm through it, pretending I'm an eel. I'm not. There's blood on my hands from the thorns on the ground, and the shoulder strap of my hawking waistcoat hooks around a stubby branch. I'm caught. I try with all my might to keep going. There's no time to turn and see where it's snagged, just brute force to try to release me. The branch snaps, and I ping forwards through the gap to land on my knees and the heels of my hands deep in a wet field of sprouting wheat. Mabel is nowhere to be seen. I run into the middle of the field and look about. The wheat is pale and rich in the spectacular glare of the winter sun. Downhill is another hedge, and behind that another, and beyond that, 1/2 acre of pasture and a pale horse. No Mabel. I stand and listen, hard. No bells, nothing. I whistle and call, nothing. I get out the telemetry receiver for the first time. Blip. Blip. The signal is strong in all directions. Radio waves propagate and bounce and confuse. I run around for ages with the aerial trying to get a fix and eventually conclude that she's sort of in that direction. I run. Down by the horse field, the ground is still frosted, white dust on hard black earth. Mabel is lost. I feel giddily, terribly alone. It's not that I'm worried about her. She'll be fine. She'll rocket around this landscape in high spirits, could live here for years. And just as I think this, a shotgun retort echoes from not far away. Oh, Christ, I think. She wouldn't live long at all. Please don't let her be shot. Don't let that noise be someone shooting her. I stand, stricken. And it is then, in the silence that follows the shot, that I hear crows. Angry crows, thank God. And I follow the noise, and of course, there is Mabel. She's sitting sun-washed on top of a hedge at the crest of the next hill. She's blazing with intent. She's chased something into cover, had seen a pheasant on the next rise and followed it here. I run across the field towards her and peer through the hedge to see where she's looking. My heart sinks. It's a jungle of saplings as tall as my shoulders, woven together with briars and brambles. Thorns, thorns, thorns. There is no way I can flush the pheasant out of that. She makes little prospecting flights out over the brush, sallies that are slow to the point of stalling before she returns to her branch, craning her neck behind her. It's in there, she's thinking. I can find it. I stand, panting, watching her for a while. We have to leave. This field and the one beyond it are not on our land. Even if I could flush that pheasant for her, it would be poaching. And we've done enough inadvertent poaching to last a lifetime. I call her. She ignores me. So, I wait. And slowly, as the minutes passed, her predatory fire cools. Now she has returned to the world I am in. She can see me again. There, she thinks. And she has a whole quail in her fist. From her sunlit perch, she descends to the hand I hold out in the shade of a hedge, and I feel a surge of indescribable relief. I start shivering, cold and hot all at once. The daybook that records White's long, lost battle with Goss is not simply about his hawk. Underneath it all is history and sexuality and childhood and landscape and mastery and medievalism and war and teaching and learning and love. All those things were going to be in the book he was writing about the hawk. When the hawk was lost, he abandoned the attempt, but not entirely, because the book, in a different form, was still being finished, and the hawk would not be lost forever. At the beginning of The Sword in the Stone, Sir Ector's son Kay takes the Wart out hawking. He picks up Cully the goshawk from the castle mews, an unwise thing to do, for the hawk is deep in the molt and wildly out of condition. After a half-hearted sally at a rabbit, the hawk takes stand on a high branch and ignores their calls. They follow it from tree to tree, whistling and luring, but the hawk is in no mood to return. Kay flies into a temper and storms home, but the wart stays with the hawk, because he cannot bear it to be lost. He follows it into the deep wildwood, and there he is afraid. Reading The Sword in the Stone after reading The Goshawk is a deeply curious thing. You start to confuse which forest is which. One is the tangled wildwood of Arthur's Britain, a refuge for outlaws, hawks, and wicked men. The other is the tangled forest around Stowe. It too is a refuge for outlaws, hawks, and wicked men. The place White hoped would give him the freedom to be who he was. Like the forests in Sir Orfeo, the forests of White's imagination exist in two worlds at once, and it is into these strange, doubled woods that the lost hawk leads the wart. In following it, the boy is drawn to his destiny, just as White had been drawn to his own by looking for Goss. Night falls. The wart sleeps under a tree, and the next morning he comes across a high gabled stone cottage in a clearing in the wood. Outside it, drawing water from a well, is a tall, elderly man with spectacles and a long white beard, wearing a gown splashed with mutes and embroidered with stars and leaves and mystical signs. It is his teacher, Merlin the magician. And when the wart walks into his cottage, he finds it is a treasury of wonderful things. Thousands of books, stuffed birds, live grass snakes in an aquarium, baby badgers, an owl called Archimedes. There is Venetian glass, a set of Encyclopedia Britannica, paint boxes, fossils, a bottle of mastic varnish, purse nets and rabbit wires, a rod box, salmon flies, and a fox's mask mounted on the wall. Nearly all of these things were in White's cottage as he wrote. The book was White's Kingdom of Grammary, wrote Sylvia Townsend Warner, where there was room and redress for anything he liked to put in it. But there is another way of reading this scene, one far less mundane than a writer's amusement at putting in his book the things around him as he writes. It is that Merlin's cottage in the woods is his own. On White's shelves were a whole clutch of books on human psychology. He'd read them, underlined passages, made notes in the margins on the pathology of sexual deviance. In Alfred Adler's Individual Psychology, he'd found a whole chapter on homosexuality. It held that the attitude of homosexuals was that of people desirous of interfering with the flight of time. Adler thought homosexuals were irresponsible because they refused to develop into heterosexual adulthood. But interfering with the flight of time? Words once read run deep. For White was certainly interfering with time. He was turning it backwards. In that green mound of a grave, he had achieved invisibility, and after he emerged, he felt he had turned St. Lucy's Day, the shortest, darkest day of the year, from which the earth rolls back towards spring. He spoke of that time as a rebirth, wrote that life seemed to be creating itself, seemed in the blank walls of chaos to be discovering an opening or speck of light. In his imagination, the grave was his dissolution. He had lost the war with Goss, and it had killed the man he was. But now, with his apocalyptic child's vision of redemption, he saw himself reborn into the world with wisdom, and reborn too as a man living backwards in time. I used to think Merlin was a magnificent literary creation, but now I think of him as a much stranger invention, White's imagined future self. Merlin was born at the wrong end of time. He must live backwards from in front, while surrounded by a lot of people living forwards from behind. This backwards life is what gives Merlin his ability to predict the future. For him, it is always his past. In White's 1941 conclusion to The Once and Future King, published much later as The Book of Merlin, Arthur awaits his final battle. He is elderly now, tired and despairing, and when Merlin appears, he wonders if the wizard is a dream. Merlin rebukes him. "When I was a third-rate schoolmaster in the 20th century," he snaps, "every single boy I ever met wrote essays for me which ended, 'Then he woke up.'" Being Merlin was White's dream, and it makes The Sword in the Stone not just a work of fiction, but a prophecy. All White must do is stay put, wait 400 years, and the wart will appear at his door. Merlin's cottage and all the things inside it are souvenirs of the distant future. "I have always been afraid of things," White had written, of being hurt and death. But now he was recreating himself as someone who would become, who was already, immortalized in legend. In the imagination, everything can be restored, everything mended, wounds healed, stories ended. White could not trap his lost hawk, but as Merlin he does, with a ring of upturned feathers and a fishing line, and brings it in triumph back to the castle with the wart. And thus White gives himself a new pupil to train, not a hawk, but the boy who will be king. He will educate him in the morality of power, inspire him to found the Round Table, to fight always for right over might. A good man's example always does instruct the ignorant and lessens their rage little by little through the ages until the spirit of the waters is content, says the grass snake to the king at the end of the Book of Merlin. For a little boy who stood in front of a toy castle convinced he would be killed, being Merlin is the best dream of all. He will wait, he will endure, and one day he will be able to stop the awful violence before it ever started. Chapter 27. The New World. It is Christmas Eve. Outside my window is an icy tidal river. Everything not fringed with silver and limned lamp black is white or Prussian blue. Those moving dots are wintering ducks, and a loon slides past them on a low submarine profile cruise to the sea. Everything is heavy with snow. I'm stuffed to the gills with pancakes and maple bacon, and I'm feeling quiet inside, quieter now than at any time since my father died. It is a deep and simple hush. My mother is asleep in the room next door, my brother is home with his in-laws, and Mabel is at Stuart and Mandy's, 3,000 miles away. Mum and I are spending Christmas in America, through the kindness of my friend Erin and his parents Harriet and Jim, who run a bed and breakfast inn on the coast of southern Maine. I met Erin years ago when I worked breeding falcons in Wales. A young surfer and falconer, he turned up at Carmarthen Station looking wildly out of place, like a clean-shaven Carrie Elwes in The Princess Bride. He'd been drawn to Britain by dreams of flying falcons, only to be put to work jet-washing aviaries in driving rain. But he survived the gloom, and we became friends. Proper friends. The kind people say you only make once, twice in a life. I visited him many times over the years, and through him I've met a crowd of wonderful Mainers. They're not much like my Cambridge friends. They're fishermen, hunters, artisans, teachers, innkeepers, guides. They make furniture, decoys, exquisite ceramic pots. They cook, they teach, they fish for lobster, take tourists out to catch striped bass. And most of them hunt. Hunting in Maine is not obviously riven with centuries of class and privilege. There are no vast pheasant shoots here where bankers vie for the largest bags, no elite grouse moors or exclusive salmon rivers. All the land can be hunted over by virtue of common law, and locals are very proud of this egalitarian tradition. Years ago, I read an article in a 1942 edition of Outdoor Life that stirred wartime sentiment by appealing to it. One of my grandfathers came from Northern Europe for the single reason that he wanted to live in a country where he could try to catch a fish without sneaking onto some nobleman's property, where the common people were excluded, one hunter explained. In fascist Italy and Germany, the article went on, hunting is limited to the owners of estates, their guests, and the high and mighty. It had to backpedal slightly, of course, for the same was true in Britain. This is no slap at our courageous ally, it explained. But we do not need her system of land management. What's more, hunting is far more acceptable here than it is in Britain. One of my friends in Maine is Scott McNeff, a wiry and energetic firebrand who runs an ice cream emporium in summer and spends the winter flying his hawks. He told me that few households in the whole state aren't touched by the November deer hunt. Even if people don't hunt deer themselves, everyone knows someone who does, and freezers across Maine are full of home-shot venison packaged and parceled out for friends and families. People swap hunting stories here the way people swap drinking stories at home. Scott took us hawking yesterday with his male red-tailed hawk, a first-year bird called Yoda. He's a handsome beast. His crown and back are chestnut brown, his underparts milk-glass white, sparsely marked with a gorget of spots and dashes. He's not as well-armed as a goss. His toes are shorter, thicker, more like fists than Mabel's armoured pianist's fingers. He has nothing of a goshawk's rangy, leopard-like hunch or contagious apprehension. His eyes are dark, his face mild and open, a thick-set, amiable hawk, an unflappable kind of hawk. And he has been borrowed from the wild. Yoda is a passage hawk, one who already knows how to hunt, who has, in the weeks since leaving his nest, had to learn 100 different ways of encountering air and rain and wind and quarry, and learn them fast to survive. American falconers are permitted to trap and fly a bird like this over its first winter, and then release it in the spring to return to the wild and breed. Falconers here can do this because they are tested and licensed by the state. It's a good system. I wish we had it at home. Scott has the kind of fluid physicality that makes everything he does beautiful to watch. He changes the hawk's jesses, checks there's food in the pocket of his battered jacket, and we set out. The ground has a deep crust of snow. Everything is poised as if it might shake itself. There are woods here. Thousands upon thousands of acres of white pine, of hemlock, spruce and oak. But that is not where we are going. We walk across what looks like a school playground. Yoda leaves Scott's fist, flies up onto a children's play frame. We clamber down a slope behind timber-lapped houses. The hawk follows. The air swallows sound, so that speaking into it, your voice stops, a foot in front of your face, in a cloud of white breath. What are we doing here? I think, Dolly. This is a town. Skittering flakes of dislodged bark fall through 30 feet of air. A family waves from an upstairs window. We wave back. The hawk is laddering up a pine tree behind their backyard fence, hoisting itself skyward with leaps and hawkish flourishes. Squirrel! Shouts Scott. And I am knee-deep in snow, coughing, my jet-lagged ears singing in the hush, attempting to follow what is happening above me. The brightness above is blank behind knots and spars of twigs and needles. The flight is the workings out of two creatures above me. Height, vantage, escape, evasion. The squirrel knows about red-tails. They live in these woods. The red-tail knows about squirrels, too, has hunted them in the wild before Scott trapped him earlier that fall. A thin branch bends and springs back as the squirrel leaps into the next tree, the hawk after it. We crane our necks up at the war above, playing out like a wild screen the enemy below. The hawk twists, the squirrel makes another leap, is silhouetted black against the sky, legs outstretched, and then a blunt black form hits it. It is the hawk. I hear the impact, see the awkward, parachuting fall through 30 feet of snowy, splintered air, and they land heavily on the ground and Scott is running in slow motion through deep snow, and when I get there, the squirrel is dead and the hawk is mantling over his prey, wings out, beak open. A thin stream of smoke climbs from his mouth. Blood has already melted a thin line through the snow, and the hawk's feet and feathers are powdered with a crumbly paste of snow and blood that resembles decorative sugar. The hawk looks up and about at his surroundings. A backyard, garages, a low fence, a barbecue heaped deep with snow, an inflatable Santa riding an inflatable Harley Davidson, icicles hanging from Christmas eaves. Somewhere I can hear a television, and beyond that, someone is singing Happy Birthday. I have never seen anything so fiercely wild and so familiar. How can it be here? How can the wild be here in this backlot, in the middle of a town, in the midst of home and community? These are the things I had flown from. It was the wildest hunt I had ever seen. Sitting by the windows, staring out at the sliding river, I begin to wonder if home can be anywhere, just as the wild can be at its fiercest in a run of suburban backlots, and a hawk might find a lookout perch on a children's playframe more useful than one on the remotest pine. Maine has given me a family for Christmas, and shown me a hawk can be part of it too. It's shown me that you can reconcile the wild. You can bring it home with you. It's our last morning. Erin, Mum and I are walking along Parsons Beach, bracing ourselves against the wind. It is a bitter, salt-cold day. We tread on frozen sand. Strings of sea ducks fly far offshore, ragged lines over soaked slate bays. The waters under them are full of lobsters. Maine is famous for them. Signs for lobster rolls hang everywhere across town. Erin's dad had been a lobsterman once, and I'd gone out fishing with them years ago. Which is to say, I sat on the deck of their boat and watched as they hauled traps, measured, sorted and banded lobsters, rebaited the traps and set them overboard. They worked for hours while I sat there, unable to help, unable to do anything except watch. They were delighted I'd come out with them, and it was a wonderful day, but I felt guilty all the same. I was an English tourist out of her depth. Walking on the beach, I remembered that boat trip and felt uncomfortable as hell. I'd spent months out with Mabel on the hill. I'd seen the harvest come in, tractors harrowing slopes, stockmen turning sheep out to winter in the fields, and I'd not spoken to anyone. No one at all. I thought of the summer tourists here, standing in packs to photograph the lobster boats coming in, or angling their cameras to catch the twisted light and shade on stacks of lobster traps on Cape Porpoise Key. Was I like that? I hadn't meant to be a tourist with my hawk. It didn't feel like tourism. But I sure as hell had avoided being part of the working world. We turn back, walking into the wind now, crunching over ice-crusted rockweed and sending sandaling flocks swirling along the tide line. The off-season streets are deserted, the hotels closed, shutters down, wooden signboards swinging in the wind. A cooper's hawk sits on the overhead stoplight on the intersection of Main Street and Western Avenue, flat-headed and fluffed as Mabel, looking down on the empty town. Back at the inn, feeling cold and horribly sober, I grab a coffee and pace about by the fire. My face is burning. I suppose it is from the wind. Mum is packing upstairs. Erin and his dad are in the kitchen. I can hear them laughing. I don't want to go back, I think. I had fled from community. At my father's memorial, I had remembered it existed. Now I am back in it, in the middle of a community, in the middle of a family home, and I do not want to leave. This place is fixing my broken heart. I can feel it mending, and I'm fearful of what will happen when I'm gone. I'm not sure how I will cope back in England, back in my jobless, hopeless, lonely old town. The back door slams. Jim is heading off in the truck to his workshop. I don't want to leave. I sulk. I fret. I scowl at the fire, hot with self-pity. Then I hear the door open, And Erin's tousled head appears round the frame. It wears a vastly conspiratorial expression. I sense a plan is brewing. And a minute later, I'm helping him drag their huge Christmas tree out of the room and onto the snowy lawn, tips snaking through the rough trail it makes, branches skittering over and cutting through the crust that glitters in the sparse light. We prop it up in the deep snow, as if it had grown there. I have no idea what is going on. "Okay, Macker, let's burn this," he says. Puzzlement. "It's traditional. It's what we do here, in America." I don't believe him for a second. "In England, we dump them on the street, traditionally," I say. "Absolutely, let's burn it." "I'll get the firelighter," he yells. I can feel the madness to this, its contagious pagan glee. He runs back from the house with a squeezy plastic bottle of firelighting gel. And in the snowy hush, fog collecting around us as the thaw turns ice to water that hangs in the warming air, he decorates the tree with gloopy green strings that drip and stick like glutinous tinsel. "Stand back," he commands. He strikes a match. A branch catches with a tearing scratch of flame. For a few moments, this is pretty, a soft yellow light in the monochromatic gloom. But then there is an explosive, tearing waterfall of rearing flame that bursts into appalling brightness. Erin's eyebrows go up. He steps back a good few paces, and now I am laughing so much I can hardly stand. "Jesus, Erin," I shout. It's as if he set light to the whole of the world. A 20-foot pyramid of flame, lighting the lawn, the house, the river, the far side of the river, sending black shadows out from trees that a moment ago were lost in darkness, and our faces are gilded with fierce orange fire. What the hell have we done? The smoke mixes with the fog, so that everything, everywhere, is on fire. The incandescent tree, black twigs sintering, clicking, crumbling, and smoke, and Erin and I now wearing the faces of people who are going to be in serious trouble. "I think we might be seeing the fire truck any moment now," Erin shouts, and we're both of us children again, delighted at what we have made, and fearful of disaster. And then the fire is out. The skeleton stands in the snow, all its complexity gone. Just a thin trunk with a few charcoal branches already damp in the steaming air. And I stare at the remains of the tree and breathe the smoke and fog from the air, and Erin makes a face at me, and I make one back. "That," he says, "was excellent." It was. A ritual burn. A ceremony of strange protective magic. Bad things had fled from that burning tree. We laugh all the way back to the house, leaving the skeleton upright in the snow. And later that day, Mum and I fly back to London. I drive her home, promise to see her soon, then make my way to Cambridge and Stuart and Mandy's house. I run to their door. I cannot wait to see my hawk. There she is, perched in their garden, fat and happy in a crowd of pointers with wagging tails. I thank Stuart for looking after her while I was gone. He stands by the patio doors, strangely drawn and tired. "No worries," he says. "I've not done much with her, to be honest. I've had flu, it's been terrible. I've been in bed all Christmas, just thrown her food." "Poor Stu," Mandy says, coming towards the table with three cups of coffee and a packet of open biscuits. "He's really been in the wars." I look at my friends and my heart crumples. They have spent so many hours helping me, have shown me so much love, and I had taken it all for granted. "Thank you. Thank you so much," I say. "I love you guys. I really do." I say it with as much feeling as I can. I am not just thanking them for looking after my hawk. I get up to give Stuart a hug. "Don't catch it," he says, backing away. I hug him anyway. On this breezy August day in 1939, White is in Ireland hiding from the war. He knows he ought to enlist, but he's persuaded himself his flight here is not mere cowardice. He'd be wasted as a soldier, he thinks.